This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Key and Codex, Secret Societies in Speculative Fiction.
Now, I think that this episode is inspired by a certain book that you've been reading, Jules.
It's kind of a topic I wanted to tackle for a little while, but this book sort of crystallised how I wanted to go about it. And that's Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo. And put it this way, if you've enjoyed the rest of her books, this book's nothing like them. So it's not that you won't enjoy it, but don't go in expecting it to be Six of Crows, because it's really not. I'll talk about it a bit more later. But the whole idea of a secret society is both kind of appealing and repellent, I think, at the same time, for lots of different reasons. Because on the one hand, with a secret society, you've got the exclusivity and the specialness and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you've also got the whole, the sort of icky white boys club, old boys club type privilege and various other unpopular agendas as well. So we'll look at that in a little bit more detail, as in sort of what is a secret society.
Yeah.
And in real life, as well as in fiction. And
it should be worth saying, of course, because the topic is so huge, we are going to be focusing on kind of magical or, you know, historical or, you know, speculative fiction secret societies rather than on all of them. So we're not really going to be touching on the things like, you know, criminal organizations or gangs or scientific outfits or anything like that today, because otherwise we'd be here all day.
Yes, we're trying to keep this episode nice and svelte rather than running into a half hour like we often do lately. So
yeah,
that's why it's mostly magical historical. Okay, so what is it about secret societies? My theory is that they're about power. And whether you think that's good or that's bad, that's essentially what it comes down to, because they tend to be the gatekeepers of knowledge, and knowledge is power. And a lot of secret societies, both in fiction and in real life, have various focuses. They can be religious in origin, they can be political, they can mm-hmm. be about this exclusivity, this sort of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, and we'll all do the secret handshake kind of thing, where there's deals sliding under tables.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating, but also really repellent, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And in very, very rare cases, a secret society can be a gatekeeper of very dangerous knowledge, and they are actually altruistic, but that tends to be the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, and we'll go into more kind of more in-depth discussion about this, but I really do think that if you look at secret societies from the outside, there, as you say, there is that kind of allure to them, but they are actually kind of scary at the same time. And I think whether a secret society is perceived as good or bad really, really depends on whether you're included within it.
Yeah, definitely.
So for instance, the secret society of and I'm only going to touch on this once really, because otherwise it will just take over. You know, Harry Potter has a level of secret society. They've got secret societies within secret societies, as it were. Start off with the Wizarding World, which is sort of not quite, but because it's this secret kept from the rest of, you know, the Muggle population, we'll say it's a kind of a secret society in that way. And then within that, you know, you then get Dumbledore's armies and stuff like that, and the main characters are obviously part of that, so we are part of it through them, so it's wonderful, you know, you're in on the whole thing, and that's fantastic. So you get those kinds of secret societies, and then you get the complete opposite, where there is a secret society working in the shadows against, you know, and that immediately what I just said, they're working in the shadows. And there's this immediate negative connotation of, ah, they are working against me. And the fact that, you know, they're secret, you know, they're shadowy, they're suspicious, who knows what they're up to. They've clearly the rest of us. And it's much the two extremes on both sides. And as I said, if you look at secret societies objectively, they are both alluring and a little bit terrifying. But it really does depend on how you frame them.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to talk about some real secret societies. Some of them are going to probably surprise you because you won't have thought of them as a secret society, but actually technically they are. So for example, the Ku Klux Klan is technically a secret society. And that would also include the Legion of White Decency. These are both generally American organisations, and they clearly have a strong political bent. And, you know, is there anybody out there who doesn't know what these particular secret societies are all about?
Because we
can explain. Basically, this is persecuting people who have too much melanin for these very, very white folk. And it, you know, this is troubling. This is a prime example of, you know, the old white boys club and why you absolutely have to treat anything that acts as a secret society and acts in the public domain as a secret society with a great deal of suspicion, because they have decided that the law does not apply to them, that what they are doing is right. And they are essentially forming an echo chamber for their own opinions. And when their own opinions have a platform of, say, racism or misogyny, then we've got some real issues there, because these are people who will then go and act on those opinions.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there is also this element of kind of a form of mass hysteria, whereby you can say, I hate this kind of person. And then someone else beside you says, I hate them as well. And then everyone is shouting, you're getting riled up and you get caught in a crowd. And now it's not just, I hate this person. It's, I'm going to go to this person's house and I'm literally going to murder them. Which as an individual, someone might not do. But the moment there is this kind of, as you say, this echo chamber, but in particular, this crowd, you kind of start to feel justified in whatever sort of violent actions you do. As you say, they start to perceive themselves to be above the law because there's a number of them and they're all saying, which is why they're so dangerous.
I mean, as humans, we crave, on some level, we always crave fellowship with other people. And that's great, except that we can then very easily step into forming them and us groups. That sort of tribal mentality is kind of hardwired into us, but then we've come a long way since that was hardwired into us. So there is no reason why we can't overcome that early programming. Things like the KKK and the Legion of White Decency, technically secret societies, but really they're only a couple of sneezes away from becoming cults. Which is another thing obviously we won't talk about today because we'd be here for a very long time.
Yeah, I think We did an episode on cults a long, long time ago, and I do think it is a subject that we do need to revisit, but we'll put that to the side for now. Just pop it into its own, pop it on the shelf for later. I think that, you know, the big clue about the Ku Klux Klan being a secret society is that there is this level of anonymity, or there's meant to be a level of anonymity to the members and things like that as well. So even though they're very publicly vocal, you don't necessarily know who all of the members are. That this is not information which is within the public domain. It'd be great if it was. Be really good if we could know, but we don't.
When choosing your secret society to join, if they all meet everywhere wearing robes and hoods that obscure their faces so that you can't point to them in a court of law, then you might want to avoid that one. moving on. We also have the Freemasons. you get some very mixed reports on Freemasons and Freemasonry. I know that in the past, the actual organisation probably has been used to prop up some less than desirable regimes and things. But I will say that without naming any names, I do actually know quite a few Freemasons, and they're a lot more open now about what they tend to do. So I'm not going to say that it's harmless, but I don't think it's not. We're not looking at the same. It's not the same. Put it this way. It's not.
Yeah, but I used to think the Freemasons was just a TV thing.
No, they're real.
I don't actually know what it is, who they are.
Well, obviously you're not supposed to know who they are. But...
no, but it's in like, you know, I just don't know what Freemason. What does it mean? What is it?
Have you ever seen that episode of The Simpsons where Homer Simpson joins what is basically the Freemasons and they all sort of tip each other the nod and the wink and do each other favours and things?
No. Sorry.
Yeah, it's sort of basically like that. That's being a bit unfair, because I will say that the Freemasons actually get together and raise quite a lot of money for charity. I'm sure they raise a lot of money for other things as well. I'm trying not to get myself targeted here, to be honest. But, you know, they don't really have that sort of power. The one thing I will say is that the Freemasons don't accept women. They will now have balls and things for their wives. Their wives are supporting figures. It has got that exclusivity, the whole sort of exclusive. You have to be sworn in by either a member of the family or a very, very close friend, and then you progress up the ranks. So if we're looking at organisations that do an awful lot of harm, I wouldn't necessarily put them in the top 10.
No.
So moving on, I'll mention Opus Dei, which is a little bit sort of, is it a cult? Is it a religion? Is it actually a secret society? It's kind of a secret society. It's a very disturbing offshoot of Catholicism.
Right.
And, you know, Dan Brown uses it in his The Da Vinci Code. And a lot of it is sort of about abnegation and self. I don't want to say self-flagellation, but there is certainly a certain amount of that going on. Mortifying the flesh to purify the spirit. It's very noticeable that, rather like Scientology, they have an awful lot of money flowing in through them from their members. And rather like Scientology, they're quite invested in keeping their female members ground down. And let's say, I didn't want to use the word humiliated, but I kind of do want to use the word humiliated. somebody did an expose on Opus Dei 2 years ago, and she sort of went undercover to join, and it did employ sort of cult tactics as well. And the church is very cagey about explaining what Opus Dei gets up to. For example, she was made to sleep on bare boards on the floor. And so with the other women.
Wow.
It's you know, and that generally they had to keep their eyes down when a man was talking to them, that sort of thing. That's sort of quite, it's not even medieval, because medieval people didn't behave like this, but that very, very backwards way of treating women. That's not all there is to it, obviously. But again, it's another thing where an organisation has money pouring into it in order for them to accomplish things. And I imagine it must benefit the Catholic Church in order to keep fairly quiet about what's going on. Catholic Church, in some ways, is actually a massive, massive secret society itself. But we won't go into that, because that would take an entire episode.
I think it would. It's also the worst kept secret. But no, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Okay, slightly more interesting, and possibly a fanciful one. The Priory of Sion turns up again in the Da Vinci Code. Dan Brown really packed out the Da Vinci Code with secret societies, as supposedly a fictional secret society. Dan Brown himself actually said in an interview that he genuinely believed these people to exist. I think that if they do exist, they must be doing a much better job of being a secret society than most secret societies, because nobody came forward and said, yes, we are the Priory of Sion. we protect the blood of Christ, etc., etc. But it's interesting, and it wouldn't surprise me if there were yet still more offshoots from various other early iterations of the Catholic Church. So before the Catholic Church came into being, when we were sort of Gnostic religious, you know, a rival church, as it were, and which led to a sort of secret society, which may or may not have been called the Priory of Zion. Again, we don't know very much, because they're quite successful if they do exist. They may well just be fictional.
I just feel like Darren Brown was just doing some investigation. Someone put a bag over his head, bundled him into the bag.
You do not talk about the Priory.
You know too much, Mr. Brown.
used in a lot of... This one is actually real. It's a historic secret society. I can't say secret society. This is going to be a very long episode. It's a historic one. It came into being in Wallachia. It's called the Order of the Dragon, and it turns up in Francis Ford Coppola's film of Dracula, and it also turns up in Maria Kova's retelling of Dracula, The Historian, which I don't recommend to anyone. But the actual order itself is there and quite interesting. And it's kind of like the Knights of the Garter, but much bloodier.
Yeah, because wasn't Vlad the Impaler, he was actually a member of it, wasn't it? Or his father was, at least.
He was a member of the Order of the Dragon. This is where you get the slight divergence, because there's no actual evidence that Bram Stoker was talking about Vlad Tepes when he wrote Dracula. It's just that was a nice thing that people linked together. In fact, if you look at all of Bram Stoker's notes, there's a good chance he was talking about someone much, much older than Vlad Tepes. But that bit of historical trivia aside, the Order of the Dragon, the idea was they took 20 boys per year. No, 20 boys every 4 or 5 years. And they were all trained secretly on a mountain temple, which, you know, already this is sounding a bit spooky cool. And 19 of them were released, and the devil kept one of them. The idea was they trained under the devil's tutelage. And the legend goes that Vlad Tepes was the 20th child, the one the devil kept. And when he was released, he was just a monster. I think that is an excellent bit of PR if you want the Turks to be really terrified of you. And you've got quite a small country like Wallachia, and you don't have the massive armies of the Ottomans, for example.
Yeah.
But the order is very, very real, and I can't really tell you very much more about it. Again, a lot of it's unconfirmed. I don't think it's still running today or anything, but as a historic order, it did actually exist.
I love that, because I knew about the Order of the Dragon. I didn't know about the whole mountain training thing. That is rather cool.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a really nice way of looking at it. Ooh, how fascinating. Thank you.
Well, again, we don't know. It's unconfirmed. That's the thing with a lot of these. But I do find them fascinating to just look at. There's obviously the Illuminati. Some people claim the Illuminati didn't exist. They have appeared in fiction in so many different guises that it's understandable why people think they didn't exist. But they did in fact exist as a small organisation that were against the church and were very much about science and mathematics and not burning people for looking through telescopes. They were quite harsh because they were being persecuted, and I think that gave them a bit of a reputation for ruthlessness and for also offing the odd person, which again is kind of understandable when you know that the Spanish Inquisition wants to kill all of you, so there's that.
Yeah, but at the same time,
as a historical society, they did actually exist.
Ah, because the whole Illuminati thing has just become so much of a joke.
Yeah, it really has. There's actually a fairly comprehensive list of people who were supposed to have been part of it, I think, but again, it's really difficult to prove, and it should be really difficult to prove because, you know, secret society.
Da Vinci was part of the Illuminati. I'm putting it out there. I have no evidence. I just pulled that out of bloody nowhere, but that's my theory now.
I think they only managed to date it back as far as the 16th century. So Da Vinci would have existed before that. But, you know, if there was a pre-Illuminati, then, yeah, you could totally see him being part of it.
Founding member.
What was his forward-thinking ideas, his science and everything.
Yep.
There's also a 17th century secret society called the Rosicrucians, who have turned up in a lot of books, and Shelley used them for a couple of his books, which weren't terribly successful. Because Shelley wasn't actually that great a writer.
No, that's the really funny thing about it, because you're talking about Percy Shelley.
Yes, not Mary Shelley. I would say Mary Shelley. But yeah, Shelley the poet. Shelley the lovelorn. Okay, the Rosicrucians were a group that were very heavily invested in mysticism and magic and the occult. And again, I can't really tell you very much more than that. It's a kind of, you've got the name now, go and Google it and see. Look at the so-called facts and see what you think of them and see if you can make any more sense of it.
Okay, that's brilliant.
Finally, I will mention this one. It's because this is an interesting, has an interesting parallel in Oxford. That is the Skull and Bones Society of Yale University in America. And again, this is a case of you have to kind of be a pledge or from a very, very wealthy family. So you've already got that old white boys, very exclusive club thing. And we have definitely had similar things over here in Oxford and Cambridge, whereby they would have, you know, pledges from the right sort of families. And it's about forging connections. In fact, it's really disturbing if you look at our Tory government, most of them came from something very similar.
Yeah, I was going to say that we've had that historically for a very, very long time. It's all about who you know and who you're introduced to in this exclusive club.
Yeah, it's very definitely one hand washes the other, that sort of thing. But I do still find it, from an objective point of view, really quite fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have that in the UK. We have it at most of the kind of the major old universities.
Yeah.
Now, actually, in a lot of the old boarding schools as well.
Yes.
It's kind of terrifying, actually, because the thing is, it's not actually a secret society, as it were. You know, you do have these groups of alumni that turn up from old schools and stuff like that, and who will have, you know, their own little groups, who will have their own connections. And technically they're not secret societies, because it's kind of a lot more sort of open public domain kind of thing. But these groups do exist, and they're just kind of one door being closed from being a secret society. It's just one closed door. Like, we're on the cusp there. And I do think you're right that it's this kind of the sense of exclusivity that we kind of enjoy, that we want to sort of say, oh, we all have this shared kind of experience, and therefore we want to kind of maintain this group. And we don't want anyone from the outside who's not had that experience to kind of look in. And because we've shared something, we have a connection with one another. So I think it is a very human thing, but it can get very dangerously us and them, as you've said.
Yeah. And obviously the problem is a lot of these university, you know, Oxford, Yale, what have you, based societies, you know, they're not secret. People know about them, and they know about the exclusivity. Otherwise, they wouldn't be desirable. But you don't really know what goes on behind closed doors, and you're not supposed to.
Yeah.
And obviously, the problem is you have to have a certain amount of privilege in order to be eligible to join in the first place. So you have to have gone to the right school, come from the right background, have the right level of income. And then you form this tight-knit community, if you like, for lack of a better word, who then go out into the world and become policymakers and influencers and politicians and people who write statute. And they're all from this same pool. And that is really, really problematic.
It is, particularly when, on the one side of it, you've got a lot of these people who are kind of working within politics. And then, at the, you know, the other side of it is that you have people who are working in, you know, businesses and banks and things like that, or, you know, certain areas, or coming from old money. And it gets to the point that because they're all part of, you know, that one group, it's, oh, well, we've got to work within our own sort of self-interest. And I think that that can sometimes cause corruption. More than sometimes, I think it does cause corruption at the highest levels. And that's a big, big problem. And a big part of that is the fact that everything is kind of done behind closed doors, and you don't know how much of it. And the other problem is that, of course, there's nothing illegal about it either. There's nothing illegal about having these kinds of exclusive clubs. And also you could say, oh, but they're not part of them now. They just happen to go to school together. They just happen to be part of this, you know, this social group. How do you prosecute that? How do you prove it? How do you, you know, do anything which will actually cause any kind of change? And you can't. You can only be aware of it.
They're probably, their lawyers are better paid than yours are, put it that way.
Yes.
Far better paid. Probably have come out from the same sort of group as well, in fact.
Yeah. So you've got in that fact, against you. So might the judge.
Yeah. So the odds are, the house is winning on that one. You know, it's stacked in the house's yes. favour, definitely. But no, Madeline touched on an interesting point there, and I think this is where we sort of, as we segue into secret societies in fiction and why they make excellent vehicles for exploring issues. And that is because the people who get drawn into these secret societies, generally the baseline, particularly in sort of the university based ones, they tend to be venal.
Yeah.
Or they are actually quite, they're prepared to be venal people. Not all of them, but just enough of them. So they're easily corruptible. I mean, there's that saying, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's like, okay, but maybe power attracts the corruptible. So maybe there's an element of that in there as well. And that's sort of encapsulated in the whole secret society idea, which is where it becomes interesting in science fiction and fantasy, where they're used to look at things like political agendas and religious doctrine, and, you know, a racist or misogynistic standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you really did touch on a very good point there about the idea of power attracting the corruptible. I do think it is very much, you give someone a tool, you give someone power, they're just going to be a bigger version of themselves. I think you really, really, you know, hit the nail on the head there, in terms of the fact that power will potentially attract the corruptible. And I really do think it's because people who want power as their ultimate goal will just continue to want power. It's very different from someone saying, I want to do this, I want to campaign for that, because they are trying to achieve something, and power might be a way in order to achieve that, but that's not their ultimate goal. If your ultimate goal is power onto itself, which for some people it is, and again, that's not necessarily a bad thing to want influence, but to want influence for the power for the sake of having influence and power, rather than because you have some sort of vision, rather than because you have some sort of ideal or idea that you want to put into place, I really think that that's where you get that very corruptible thing, because as long as this person is getting what they want, which is power, nothing else sort of necessarily matters, and lines kind of sort of just get moved and erased and blur.
It's understandable then that obviously science fiction, fantasy, speculative fiction, which is very much an echo of the time in which it's written, would then use this as a vehicle in order to explore the issue of power and what end that power is being devoted to. So we're going to look at some secret societies now.
Yes.
I'll briefly mention the Houses of the Veil from Ninth House. Just because it's just such a good example of everything we've literally just been talking about. So without going too much into the plot, in Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo, the Houses of the Veil are 8 houses at Yale University, one of which is actually called Skull and Bones. And they're a house about necromancy, which is brilliant. I'm sure the real Skull and Bones isn't actually about necromancy, but I love it. I love it in the book. It's brilliant. And all of these houses, these 8 houses, yes, you've got the problem of them being places for the privileged and you know, pledges are seeded there. Parents, generations of yeah. students have gone to these same houses. It's the wealthy, it's, you know, it's the entitled. And there is a lot of exploration of classism using these houses. Then you add to that problem by these eight houses actually all having specific magical disciplines as well. And it's nasty magic. This is not, this is rough stuff. This is not a case of, oh, I can make flowers grow or what have you. This is a case of, no, we use entrail divination we abduct severely disturbed patients from mental wards, sedate them, and then open them up to read the entrails and stitch them back up again and send them off. And what we divine from the entrails is used to inform politicians and lawyers and the stock market.
Oh, wow.
There is very, very little. In fact, if you can find anything really good or altruistic in that, then I would genuinely want to know.
Oh, my God.
Now, so all of the houses are kind of like that. I won't detail them. But it's the triple whammy. It's the privileged, it's the old white boys club network, and then they've got real magical power on top of it. And they are basically children playing with a volcano. And it's quite disturbing, and it gets quite gory in places. The ninth house is
called... Wow, okay.
The ninth house itself doesn't use a particular magical nexus. It doesn't have a particular discipline. The idea of the ninth house is to ensure that the other eight houses don't go too far, don't get found out by the, you know, Joe Public.
Yeah.
With mixed results, shall we say, because if someone who has power and wealth starts to feel they're losing it, where do they draw the line in trying to hold on to it and get it back? So that is really largely what the book is about. But I loved the secret societies in that. They were horrible. There was very little about them that was redeemable, and it was such a brilliant exploration of the class system, which most people say, oh, we don't have a class system. It's like, if you can say that, it's because you're not living very low down in the class system.
It is amazing, because America does have a serious class system,
yeah.
Despite the fact that America doesn't have nobility or royalty. There is a serious class system.
Yep, big time.
And there is a very serious class system here in Britain as well. Very significant.
It would be the Talamasca from Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles and Witches series. I really love the Talamasca. The Talamasca study the supernatural, but, you know, Anne Rice is supernatural, which means it's pretty dark.
Mm-hmm.
And they have existed for hundreds of years. Their motto is we watch and we are always here, which is pretty creepy if you just read it literally.
Yeah.
And they keep dossiers on vampires of specific interest, on the witches themselves, on the entire Mayfair clan family. So there are parts of it where they actually know the Mayfair history better than the Mayfair witches themselves. But they are children playing in traffic. Again, they are gatekeepers of dangerous knowledge, but they're keeping this knowledge as much because it fascinates them as anything else, which, you know, leads to a few Talamascan agent deaths, because they get so fat, they're like moths to a flame. They're so fascinated by these supernatural creatures that they are following, that they're studying, they forget that these creatures have powers, you know, and might well be aware that they're being watched.
And actually exist.
They are scientists so enchanted with the voyage of discovery that they forget that inhaling fumes from acid and things like that are bad for you. So I find them really interesting. They are probably among the most altruistic of societies, and they do reach out, for example, to the Mayfair witches and try to help them with one of the familiar spirits that is causing a lot of problems. But at the same time, you can't ever say they're completely altruistic, because why did they start studying these things in the first place? They don't ever intervene. They're kind of like nature documenters.
Yeah. Which the whole thing about that is that actually when it comes down to, you know, the fact that there are actual lives at stake, it starts to get a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
Really.
Definitely. But they are, again, fascinating, and they were one of the big perks of the books for me.
Yeah. It makes me think of... I've got a couple as well from some TV series, which kind of dabble in sort of similar things. So the first is The Men of Letters.
Yeah.
From Supernatural.
Oh, yeah.
Now, with it, so in Supernatural, basically, there is this kind of the secret organization who kind of document magic, and they learn everything about all these kind of supernatural creatures. There are different branches in different countries, particularly, you know, we see them in America and in Britain, and they're not hunters. So hunters are a separate thing. Hunters are kind of more like individuals who just sort of take up arms, really, and sort of go hunting. They do kind of dabble in summons and stuff like that every now and again, which is kind of what causes a big problem of actually how we're introduced to the Men of Letters, where basically it's the two characters, Sam and Dean, discover that their grandfather was in fact a man of letters, and they meet him when he accidentally goes forward in time after a mess up of a certain ritual. And they basically kind of inherit this bunker, which is just full of knowledge and information and sort of tracking things. And every now and again, the Men of Letters basically kind of handle some of the supernatural stuff. So they might handle, occasionally they do kind of work with hunters, or they themselves are hunters. The Men of Letters become an antagonistic force sort of within the Supernatural series. I kind of didn't really watch much into that season, but they kind of start to expand into America because the American branch completely died out. I think they were all murdered, so that was good. So the British branch, of course, come into sort of America, and they torture Sam and Dean a little bit, and then they kind of work with Sam and Dean, and then they're murdering people, you know, mostly monsters, and there's kind of no grey area. They're very extreme, and they keep things kind of very closely guarded. And they really do exist in that. You don't know who's on the next level. You don't know whether they're lying, whether they're actually helping, whether they've got their own agenda. And it's this very kind of closed club, which, yeah, as I said, I didn't really watch much into that series, but I think thought it was a good example of a secret society. On the other side of that, rather than a secret society who are kind of studying magic, I want to mention the Society of the Blind Eye from the series Gravity Falls.
Yeah.
Now, if any of you have watched Gravity Falls, it's this brilliant, brilliant TV show for kids. It's this cartoon, which I think was one of my Dissecting Dragons recommendations way back when, but it's fantastic. Following these two twins, Dipper and Mabel, who go to visit their great uncle, Stan, in this kind of little place called Gravity Falls, which is full, and I mean full, of weird stuff. They have all sorts of kind of monsters and creatures, and Dipper and Mabel seem to be the only ones who are really aware of it. Like, at one point they go to the pool and there's literally a mermaid living in the pool, and like no one has noticed. So they've got all these things, and then finally in the second season they sort of explain that what's happened is that actually the people of Gravity Falls have encountered all of these weird things, including like aliens and stuff like that, but there is a secret society which is going around erasing their memories with a device which was created by one of the characters, and I'm not going to go into spoilers, but they've been going around erasing people's memories, which is causing these people who've been had their memories erased over and over and over again, it's causing them to go really, really kind of crazy, which is why all the characters are so bizarre in Gravity Falls, because they've had their brains messed with over and over again, because every other day they're bumping into some sort of magical creature, and the secret society is to like, no, it's going to be pandemonium, I'm going to go crazy, so we'll just have to make them forget. And I just thought it was a really nice way of doing it, because usually you get these secret societies which are dabbling in magic or studying magic, whereas this secret society which is like, no, we hate magic, and to protect our town we're going to try and make everyone forget about it.
The other one I would like to mention is the Watchers Council from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yes.
Which is kind of the epitome of secret societies, really. In this, I mean, you kind of feel that maybe Joss Whedon was sort of both admiring and also taking the piss out of the British there, because 90% of the Watchers Council is British.
Yeah.
They all wear tweed. This is where we keep all the occult books, apparently, in Britain. Spoiler alert, actually, the Catholic Church has got most of them. In the Vatican. The occult library is quite extensive. And it's just, obviously, the Watchers Council purpose is to train the Slayers. But there's only ever one Slayer in a generation, right up until the end of the seventh season. So hundreds and thousands of years, there's only ever been one Slayer to train. But the rest of the Watchers Council has to do things too. So as you sort of get into the more expanded universe, you find out that they've actually got a lot going on. You're born into the Watchers Council. So they all sort of marry each other and have children, and their children are brought up to be Watchers as well, which sort of messes some of them up quite a bit. So they specialise.
Well, I was going to say, it's starting to sound quite incestuous.
depends how many you've got for a stable breeding population. But let's assume it was stable. It wasn't
okay. Just
cousins marrying cousins or anything. but it's really fascinating. And again, they suffer from the same problem that most secret societies that are sort of locked away from the world suffer from, in that they've spent so much time focused on what their mission is that they have become this echo chamber and stopped really sort of interacting with the world around them quite as much.
So yeah.
They're still seeing the Slayers as just tools to be trained, and ultimately a Slayer's duty is to die in the line of her work. Right up until Buffy, who's kind of like, no, I don't like that plan very much.
Yeah. I'd actually kind of like to live.
I'm going to have friends and things. I mean, the idea of Buffy is the exception, because unless you've looked into the expanded universe, she was the only one of the Slayers who actually grew up away from a Watchers Council enclave. So all the other Slayers, they've got a way of detecting potential Slayers, as we know. They find them very yeah. early in their lives, and they persuade or extort their parents into giving the Slayers up. So the Slayers are basically brought up in these communes.
Yeah, that's healthy.
Yeah, so again, squicky and yet really fascinating at the same time.
I'm trying to think of some examples of positive secret societies, as in secret societies that kind of do good, or, you know, are secret, you know, for to help protect people, as it were. And I'm kind of struggling, but I know they do exist.
Yeah, you'd probably be looking at the Order of the Phoenix.
In fiction, I should add.
Yeah, okay,
that's a very good example. Yeah, the Order of the Phoenix, who are kind of acting outside of the law, but are actually, you know, trying to do good because the law is wrong. But that being said, you know, that's definitely a secret society, and even though, you know, we're on their side, because absolutely their things have been messed up, the whole policy of wealth, everyone else is wrong and we're right, as we discussed at the beginning, is a little bit dangerous, really.
Yes, obviously the Order of the Phoenix rose in direct response to Voldemort's own secret society, which obviously didn't stay secret, because its end game was to bring about a new order on Earth,
yeah.
which obviously is the Death Eaters. But obviously, you start off, if that's your end game, you start off with your followers in secret, and they meet in masks and robes. Can you see the warning signs here already? That's before they yeah. brand your flesh with something that burns to bring you to your master. So
yeah, if you betray, you know, you walk away, then it's a death sentence as well.
Yeah, I mean, they...
That's a good way of keeping loyalty. Okay, but, like, this is you now. You are stuck with us. That's a very good way of keeping things secret and keeping things within the confines, really, isn't it?
Yeah, see, on a slight tangent, but I promise it's relevant. Back in the old days, when it was still illegal to practice witchcraft as a religion, and could be persecuted quite severely, what they used to do was take, if you were part of a circle and you practiced ritual magic, they used to take your measure. And the way they did this was with specific cords, the length of certain parts of your body. And that's not as dark as it sounds. And then if you ever betrayed your circle, then they tended to hang you with those cords or use them against you in other ways. Now it's tradition, I understand, from ritual practitioners, for them to still take your measure, but then the cords are entrusted back to you as a sign of good faith that you will not betray anyone.
Yeah.
Little bit of background there. Again, this is one of the things with the real secret societies whereby we don't really know, because it's not like people were writing a lot of this down, or the whole point of it being secret was that other people didn't know about it, so you couldn't be prosecuted or persecuted either way. But it is interesting, and that is sort of, I feel, with like the Death Eaters, that was kind of drawn upon, even if it wasn't deliberately so. It's not too much of a stretch, I think, for a group of magical Nazis who would be, you know, obviously acting outside the law, and to keep it all secret under pain of death until they're ready to make their move.
Yeah. It is also interesting that within the Order of the Phoenix as well, the secret society arises, which I've mentioned, which is Dumbledore's army.
Yeah, not really within the Order of the Phoenix, though.
No, sorry. No, but when I meant the Order of the Phoenix, I meant the book rather than...
Oh, sorry.
The actual Order of the Phoenix. No, sorry, that's my fault for not clarifying. So in the book, what happens is that Umbridge basically makes this rule where people are not allowed to gather in groups, I think, are larger than three or something like that. Or, you know, it's something ridiculous. Where,
without teacher approval, yeah, without, isn't it?
Without teacher approval. And it's this whole idea that she kind of doesn't want people rallying. And, you know, that they're being fed propaganda, they're being controlled. And so this group kind of forms, but in order to be able to operate secret. And they do act, you know, they have a secret, you know, they've got like secret ways of communicating. They've got those badges. They've got secret meetings. They've got a secret meeting room. And there's even consequences if, you know, because someone does betray them, is kind of forced into betraying them. And Hermione curses her, which was kind of scary, actually, that whole thing, because they're all... this poor girl, you know, like her mother works at the ministry and pushed into, you know, she her mother was threatened, and so this girl kind of had to reveal everything, and she gets marked by Hermione who kind of puts this sort of spell on everyone, that if anyone does betray them, they will be very clearly marked. So it is kind of scary, and it's definitely a secret society, which is one born out of necessity because of this repression which is occurring. And throughout history, lots of secret societies have also kind of been born out of that as well. The Hidden Christians in Japan, for instance, is another example. And if you ever go down to Kumamoto and kind of all of the southern isles, you find all these little signs, you know, even in castle walls and stuff like that. I think there's just one tile which is in the shape of a cross somewhere, which is kind of meant to be this little sign for anyone who was looking that there was a Christian practicing within the building, and you know, that there were certain places you could go. So there's all these kind of little cryptic so that people could practice religion. And the same, you know, with in Britain as well, when, you know, we went from Catholic to Protestant, back to Catholic, you know, Church of England, so we did, you know, had times where people would have secret signs, secret ways of communicating their religion, and would meet in secret ways so that they could practice their religion. So there's lots of secret societies which have not been Illuminati way, but have sort of been born out.
To be fair to the Illuminati, yeah. They just didn't want the people burned alive for wanting to know mathematics. So
yeah, okay, that was a sorry. When I said Illuminati, I did mean in the kind of the jokey way, rather than the actual Illuminati. But you know, I meant the kind of the Nick Cage Illuminati, if that makes sense. but yeah, the actual Illuminati, again, kind of born out of necessity because people like them were being murdered, so and just kind of wanted to actually progress humanity, and maybe kind of rejected the extremes of the society around them. So there's lots of secret societies in that way, that have been born throughout history.
Yeah, that there are definitely, as you say, it's not just about power. It's about the ability to, or certainly these smaller secret societies, like a lot of the early Christians as well. The whole symbol of ichthus, whereby someone would draw half a curve on the ground, and if the other person completed it, you knew you were safe to talk to them because they were also a Christian. This is before it became the Catholic Church, and then started persecuting people, interestingly enough. Going back to what you were saying about Japan, yeah, obviously during the 17th and 18th century in Japan, the purity laws were very stringently enforced. White people were not actually permitted to set foot on Japan itself. That's why Nagasaki was built, to be a sort of interim place, because they wanted to trade with the Dutch traders and the French and the English, but they didn't actually want any white people polluting their gene pool. And Christianity was absolutely banned. There had been missionaries before that, and they did not like the spread of Christianity amongst their native religion. So if they found you practicing Christianity on, you know, sort of Nagasaki itself or nearby, then the punishment was boiling alive in oil. It was an extremely unpleasant death. So, yeah, if you wanted to worship your own religion, then it was advisable to keep it secret.
Yeah, it was an incredibly violent time. You know, again, we also had our very violent times to do with religion as well. Oh, yeah, so
the whole Witchcraft Act, for example. Yeah. So. So nobody is absolutely blameless in this equation. They're really, really not.
No.
Have you got any other fictional examples you want to talk about? Because otherwise I think we should wrap it up there.
I think we should. We are kind of running out of time. There are definitely more examples.
Yes.
So if you guys can think of any, leave us a comment, let us know. Before we go, however, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
I do. I have a subject-appropriate one, which I've already mentioned, and it's Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo. This is not a young adult book. It's not like Six of Crows or any of her other books. Don't go in thinking it is. It does not hold your hand. It does not ease you into things. It's graphic in places. It's extremely violent in places. It's also an excellent dark adult fantasy book. And a murder mystery as well. So it was right up my street. To start off with, there is a slightly off-putting style, because it's reflective of the character. The main character, Alex Stern, has come from a very difficult, impoverished background. She's really underprivileged. And yet, she manages to get a place at Yale through sheer dumb luck when everybody is murdered around her one night. Because it turns out that she has a skill that the Houses of the Vale in Yale, actually really value.
The rains in Spain.
God, it's a bit like that, isn't it? Anyway, and they want to make her part of Ninth House, whereby she will train to be kind of this overseer of the eight houses and make sure that fair play is observed. And then on one of her watches, a girl is murdered who may not be anything to do with any of it. But she's kind of drawn into investigating because this girl could have been her 6 months before. This girl was dealing drugs, and clearly got into a bad place with a bad bloke, or, you know, a not great bloke. And everyone just wants to sweep it under the rug as, oh, drug deal went wrong. She made her bed, she's lying in it, kind of thing. And something makes her think, no, that's not right. Because if I won't value one girl like me, then I'm obviously not valuing myself. And it goes on from there. And, you know, it turns into quite a wild ride, but you need to give it at least a third of the book where you don't really know what's going on and nobody's handing you the answers. You're being asked to work at what you're reading before it really gets going. I think it's excellent. I can't wait for the next one. I genuinely think it's the best thing Bardugo's actually written. And if you happen to have seen online, there's been lots of trigger warnings and things for this book. Those things are kind of, yes, they're in there, but they're not gratuitous. They really are part of the story. This isn't a case of I've written something to be a bit shocking. This is a case of, no, this shit happens, and this is how we deal with it in a magical related story. Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't ever have to deal with these sort of things? So, bear that in mind.
Okay, that's brilliant. Well, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys. We'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.